Thank you, Kevin. My name is Bill Hutcherson, and I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
And it's only through the grace of God that I'm with y'all tonight, or with anyone else. I pulled up yesterday and with my wife. Mount Eagle's a beautiful place. I'd never been here before. There was a man standing at the door, and I don't know anything really about the place, and I said, "Helen, that's either Roy Rogers or Clark Gable." Where have we come to? Nice to meet you, Jim. I've got a tape of Jim. I've never played it. But when I go back home, I want you to know, Jim, that I probably will. I also need you all to know that you're going to hear a good AA talk, because I know that most of you will be here Sunday when Jack Houston talks. And I know he gives a good AA talk, so you're in for a treat. You know, Milton and I eat lunch together every Wednesday, and we have conversations. And I want you to know that the only way that I know what I know, the little bit that I do, is because you people have shared with me. Because, you know, the way this deal works, for me, I had to be taught. And in order for me to be taught anything, someone had to have a lot of patience. And I want to thank you, Milton, for your patience. Milton said that a retreat is an orderly withdrawal from the daily round of life. That doesn't sound like Milton, does it? But he said that. And because it didn't sound like Milton, I really listened to it. And that's what this place is, an orderly withdrawal from the daily round of life. And I want you to know I thank you so much for allowing me to be here, because I needed a orderly withdrawal from the daily round of life in the worst way. Because, you know, I pulled up and I wasn't in the best spiritual place last night. Not bad, not good, just not in the best spiritual place. We've all been there. And I'm in an AA meeting and we're about halfway through it, and I'm not sure I want to be here. One of your board members made the comment that life was much more than going out and making money. I know that. Sometimes I forget it and I need to be told again. And it hit me. It hit me like a diamond bullet right between the eyes that I was in exactly the right place. And as usual, I was exactly where I was supposed to be again with my kind of people. With my kind of people. I also can't come and speak before you tonight without mentioning someone who's a friend of mine and a friend of most of y'all, Franklin W. And I tell you a funny story. Franklin is sitting in his bed right now, and he can't tell you what day it is or how old he is or where he is. But I tell you this, if you take a new drunk there and you tell him, "Franklin, this man's having trouble with surrender," you're going to hear the word Red McGinnis pretty quick. He's going to tell you how it was for him, and he's going to share his experience, strength, and hope, because you see, God has chosen that Franklin not lose any of those thoughts about y'all. So Franklin is with you tonight too. Franklin could tell you when he was on the last program with Jim there, right now, hasn't lost any of it. And I walked in his room before I came down here, and he said, "Bill, What happened to that old boy that was going to go up to Mount Eagle and speak? And I said, Franklin, that's me, and I'm going to leave here in a couple of days. He goes, oh, yeah, I forgot. Well, you know, you won't do as good as you think you will. See, I think we know each other no matter what condition we're in. You know, I also believe in the singleness of purpose in AA. Because I stand before you as an ex-alcoholic and but you know, today I know that I'm more of a liar and a thief and things like that than I was the other thing. And you know, I can illustrate that best by my good friend Carl D, who he and I hold meetings at our home group called Turning Point in Memphis. And we were given that group by Norwood. He passed it on to us. Some of you know Norwood if you're in Memphis. Anyway, Carl travels. He's a traveling salesman, and he was in a little town in Arkansas, and he made a phone call and made some inquiries and found out where there was a meeting, and he needed a meeting. But right before his meeting, he made a big sale that day, and all of a sudden his day just turned around. He made some of that money, and his ego was feeling really good, and he hit that meeting feeling high, like he was the king of the world. And he started talking to the people out front, and they were carrying on, and things were good, and they got inside where the meeting was, and it was getting close to 8 o'clock, and Carl had about 7, 8 years by then, and these people only had maybe 6 months, a year, in the program. So they said, Carl, why don't you chair? I know you don't come here, but you know, you've got... He said, okay. He kept talking, drinking coffee, carrying on, letting them know about who he was and all the things he had done, and ego just oozing up. So he didn't bother to get the book or anything to start chairing, and 8 o'clock came. Minute after 8, he hopped in the chairman's seat, opened the book, and it said, I'd like to welcome you to this meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. I don't know about you, but I need to talk about alcoholism. And I have to talk about alcoholism from my first experience with alcoholism, and that was with my father. And I want you to know that I couldn't always say this. My father's dead now, but I love that man. And he was a drunk, like a lot of us. And there's not much I haven't seen. And if I asked for a show of hands tonight, at least half of you would raise your hands, more than that, probably, and say that you lived with an alcoholic. And we get to laughing and carrying on, and I certainly do. But you know, I don't want to ever forget what that's like. Before I ever became a practicing alcoholic, I knew something about alcoholism. And I also, therefore, knew something about pain. I knew something about pain. You know, if self-knowledge was any good for us at all, I would never have taken a drink. My father was a vigorous man, an intelligent man, could build a house from the ground up and never made a living doing it. From a generation of people, from a lot of your generation of people, the world will never see the likes of you again. Because believe me, necessity is the mother of invention. And you people helped build this country, and so did my father. But you know what? He couldn't quit drinking. He couldn't quit drinking. And all the guilt and the remorse that I know he felt now after he had passed away, you know, I feel like I have a kinship with my father now that I never had before, because I believe I understand what he went through. I believe I do. So, you know, those memories that I have now are tainted with a lot of joy, and those memories used to be real hurtful and sad. But because I'm supposed to share with you my experience and my strength and my hope, I must tell you that I know what it's like to see a kitchen explode with dishes flying across the room. I know what it's like to see a mother passed out in front of your eyes because she's been choked till she passed out. I know what it's like to watch those headlights hoping, wondering when your father was going to be home. I know what it's like going out night after night and finding him with the car still running, hunched over on the steering wheel. Somehow he had made it home again. I know what it's like as an adolescent to go to jail and get a father out of jail. I know what it's like to have high school friends come and say, "Hey, I work in the hospital, you know, part-time, and your dad's got lots of records over there, some about barroom brawls, you know, things like that. Alcoholism. So I believe that this is a family disease, and I believe it's a disease. Doesn't really matter. And I always have to ask myself, why do I drink? Why did I drink? And our textbook, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, tells me why. I drank for the effect. I drank for the effect. I had to have something. I remember shortly before I came into this fellowship, I can remember it as clear as I can remember anything, I was speaking with my wife Helen, who's still my wife today. And I looked at her straight in the eye and I said, "Helen, I've got to have something." And it wasn't one of those drinks that you need when you're shaken. I was letting her know that I had to have the long-term drink. I had to have something for the rest of my life. I knew I couldn't live life sober. I couldn't do it. I had to have something. And you know, today I know I was right. I did have to have something. And I found it in what you people in this program have given me. I do have to have something. And it's right here in this textbook. As Milton says, this is our textbook. There is no other. And I believe that. I had my first drink of alcohol in a glamorous place in Europe called Paris, France. My father was a career military person, a rough, gruff, but smart guy. And he had gone back to see a lady that he had known when he was there after World War II. And we found her. He hadn't seen her in 20 years. And we went into her kitchen and she poured a glass of some kind of grain alcohol. It was clear. And poured me a shot too. And I drank it down because they did. And I don't know about any of you, but I felt that drink in my thighs. I still can feel that feeling right now. It affects other people in different areas of their body. But it was in my thighs, and I said, "Dad, this stuff makes me feel funny." And he said, "Son, if you can't take it, don't drink it." It's pretty good advice. It's like a man's kind of advice, doesn't it? But I could take it, and I did take it. And I proceeded to live in Europe for 3 years in Germany with my parents. And in Germany at that time, if you had the money, you could drink at any age. You might still be able to. And so, as a 12-year-old kid, I went to bars and I drank. I get people ask me from time to time, "Where'd you get the money to drink?" Some people are pretty stupid, aren't they? I got the money to drink. And I did. And you know, I discovered something. I discovered that I loved the smoke. I love the smell. I loved the woman's perfume. I loved everything there was about the drinking life. The drinking life. But you know, even at that time, I still had to have something. And I was just discovering alcohol did for me what I needed to live life from the very beginning. Went back to the United States after 3 years in Germany And this started my period of what I call the not fitting in period. And I guess that might make some sense, you know. But I came back and I couldn't drink anymore, at least the way that I wanted to. And I was now in Texas, and I didn't like Texas. And I proceeded to, I suppose, have a normal, what I might call normal, early adolescence. And I think everybody's adolescence is a mixture of good and bad, and mine was as well. Got into high school, and you know what? A sad thing happened in high school. I didn't get to drink as much as I wanted to or was capable of. Because, you see, I thought I was a great athlete. And I wasn't. I know today I was an average athlete, but I had a coach that kind of took me under his wing, and he didn't think I was a great athlete either, now that I think back on it, but he knew that I might get in some real trouble if somebody didn't pay some attention maybe to me. Anyway, like most of us, there have been people in our lives who've cared about us. We just didn't know it at the time. At least I didn't. Anyway, that caused me not to drink maybe as much as I should. So I didn't get in as much trouble in high school as some people. So I call my high school drinking normal. I really do. Had some good times. But you know, something happened about my sophomore year in high school, and I don't know what it was, but I developed a bad case of what I now know is fear. And as far as I know, that's when my problems really started. Because my problem is right up here in my mind. I can't tell you the exact date that this fear started, but I know that I did not have it, at least to the degree that I'm describing to you now, until about my sophomore year in high school. And this is how it manifested itself in me when I wasn't drinking. I started not to do anything unless I knew that I could do it well. And you know, for me, that limits my area of action. But that's really sad if you think about it. And it caused me, for the next 15 years, to live a very, very sad, poor life. Because you see, if you only do things you know you can win at, or if you only do things you know you're good at, how can you ever learn to do anything new? You can't do anything new in this world well the first time you do it. You got to learn it. But that's how I was. And I had no idea I was doing that. None. Had no idea that's how I was living my life. Had no idea. But that fear, that indescribable fear, until I worked the steps of this program, I never got a handle that I was afraid. I might get mad. I might get mad because, you see, if I get mad, I go right past the fear and I'm into just being mad. And I don't feel the fear. All I do is feel the anger, and I can say to you, I'm not afraid of anybody or anything, because I wasn't afraid of anybody or anything when I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to heck with surrender, I wasn't going to surrender. I wasn't going to surrender. A man doesn't do that, at least ways a man that was raised the way I was raised. About this time, my mother got sick with cancer. And she was supposed to live about 6 months, and she lived about 5 years. And she was a fighter. And I took care of her. And you know, that's probably the only time in life I ever cared for someone else, and I didn't do a very good job of that, because you see, I was filled with one other thing besides being selfish. I mean, besides being full of fear, and that was I was selfish, and still didn't know that I was selfish and self-centered. And the best way that I can illustrate that, not that you need convincing that I'm selfish and self-centered, is that I was sitting in my driveway, and my mother had gotten so sick she was in a nursing home, and my father was drunk, and he told me, son, on his drunk bed, your mother hadn't had any clean clothes in over a week at that nursing home. Would you please go over there and get her clothes and bring them home and wash them for her and take them back to her? And I said, yes, Dad, I'll do that. And so I was sitting in my driveway, and if I took a right, I would go a few miles to the nursing home. And if I took a left, I would end up at a girl's house that I thought I was really in love with. You know, that kind of love you only have when you're in high school. Which way did I turn? Turn left, you see. Selfish and self-centered, driven by 100 forms of fear. Selfish and self-centered. Alcoholism. I went to college. The second week I was in college, I came walking back in to my parents' house with my proverbial tail tucked between my legs. Because you see, a good way to get kicked out of college is to take all your clothes off and wander over to the girls' dormitory. Another way to get caught is to get dressed next to a parked police car with two policemen in it. Alcoholism. But you know, I can laugh at that now, but I remember that feeling like it was yesterday, walking into that house and looking at my sick mother and her looking at me, the apple of her eye, and I had just gotten kicked out of college. Alcoholism. I got back into college. And I proceeded to get in trouble more and more often. But you know, the fear did one good thing for me at this time. I was so scared that I just about quit drinking for 6 months. And you know, I worked real hard and I made good grades. And then I wasn't afraid anymore. And so I went back off to the races. And you know, I needed one fourth semester Spanish class to get out of college one summer. And you know, by the time you've had four semesters of a language, you should at least be able to get up and, you know, say your name, maybe like order some eggs or something. And I couldn't even do that, literally, folks, could not do it. And there again, some stupid people ask, well, how did you get that far? Well, we have a way of getting by. Anyway, I needed to make a grade on this test and this final exam, and I knew I didn't make it. So I went to the professor's office and said, you know, did I pass the exam? He said, no, you didn't. But you know, I had found something out about this professor, and that was that he liked to do some things like we like to do. And I pointed that out to him, that word was out, that he better be careful. You know, you don't want that kind of thing getting around to the wrong people. I don't know about anybody else, but that's blackmail. Alcoholism. I got out of college by the skin of my teeth. And when I got out of college, I had no idea that I was a liar and a cheat and an alcoholic, and I had no conception of who I was. And I had no idea that there was a power greater than myself. But I had a pocket full of excuses if I wanted to use them as to why my life wasn't going the way I wanted it to go. So I took my first geographic cure. I worked for a year or so, saved a little money, and I was going to travel the world. An alcoholic's world can be pretty small sometimes. I went to New York for a while and went to Atlantic City. There is a God. I remember pulling into Atlantic City drunk as can be, 3 a.m, smoking cigars, pulled over a policeman that was on a horse and said, hey, where are the casinos? He just told me where they were. God watches out for us all the time. And you know, I know today that most of the lessons that most people learn on their mother's knee, they were taught to me, but I never understood them. I never understood them. Most of the slogans that we have in this program, I know today, I was taught and told They just couldn't go through this selfish, self-centered brain of mine. They couldn't permeate. My mother told me that the greatest power in this world was love, but I didn't think it was true. My mother told me that you reap what you sow, but I didn't believe it. My mother told me to do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, but I didn't think there was any power or virtue in that. I wanted to believe in something because, you see, I needed something. I did have no power. That was my problem. And that's why I was going through my phase of, I call my depressed phase. Of course, I just described to you who and what I was, so why wouldn't you be a little depressed at that time? I know that now. But you see, the real reason I was depressed is I didn't have any power in my life, and I had no idea where to get it. So at this point, I ended up in Memphis, Tennessee, and I hit what should have been my first bottom, but it wasn't. I lived with my sister here for about a month, and she may or may not be one of us. That's for her to decide. But I had a brother-in-law, and I could talk all night about him because he's a very unique person. He's not one of us. But you know, our fellowship was started with a lot of help from people who are not one of us. And I know most of you out there have had help from people who were not one of us. Well, this man did me the biggest favor that anybody could do. And I'm going to tell you about it here in just a minute. But before I do that, I want you to know I had just enough money left at this time to get an old rat trap of a place on Southern Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee, by the stockyards, railroad tracks. Milton knows where it is. And for the next 30 days, I didn't eat anything. All I did was drink. And I was depressed. And you know, if you don't eat anything for about a month, and you run out of money, and you run out of something to drink, and you hear your father's coming into town, and you go over to see that sister, and the only reason you could do that was because your dad was in town, and you walk in and you look like you do, and you kind of walk in like everything's fine, and they offer you something to eat. A sensible person would take something to eat, wouldn't they? I did. I took a piece of chocolate cake, and that's all I ate. Alcoholism, insanity. And you know, it's not like I had to tell them things were wrong the way I looked, but nobody said too much. They didn't know what was wrong with me. About a week later, I was in the same shape, and that little brother-in-law I was telling you about came up to me and said the following words, "Bill, I need you in my business." And a light just went off. Finally, somebody recognizes my greatness. You see, I wasn't born of any noble birth. I had no money, no special education, and no special talent. But yet I always thought, from the time of my first conscious thoughts on this planet, that I was supposed to be something great. So evidently my brother-in-law has discovered in me what I always knew was there, but what no one else had ever seen. And I said, "Alan, I'll be glad to work in your business. How can I help you? What do I have to offer to you?" And he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, "Billy," he called me Billy, "you've got larceny in your heart." Larceny? The only time I'd ever heard that word was maybe an old Perry Mason show. Larceny's not a good word. But he meant it. He meant just what he said. So the next time an aluminum siding salesman knocks on your door, be nice to him. Folks, I was in the siding business. And I made more money than I'd ever seen before. And he did honest work, by the way. I shouldn't say that from the podium. He did. But anyway, I now was an alcoholic with a pocket full of money. And that was not a good thing. Because now I now enter my what I call my off-to-the-races period of alcoholism. I had come into my own. I could now buy the drinks. I could now tell the tallest tales, or just as tall a tale. And every night was New Year's Eve, I thought. I went back to Texas and got what belongings I had and came back to Memphis, and as I say, was off to the races. And I, for a short time became a social worker. Boy, now that's a depressing job. People say that a bad job is one that they hate. That's not true. The worst job to have is one that you're not good at. So that says enough about my social work career. So I went back in the sales game, and I was a good salesman. No question about that. And you know, for me, I think that us alcoholics work harder than most people. At least for me, I knew at some point, I worked for years because I harder than anybody, because I knew at some point I was going to be found out for what I was. And when I was found out by my employer for what I was, I could point to the fact, well, look at all this stuff I had done for you. I went for years, no trouble, getting in trouble. I just knew what I was. And I knew sooner or later I was going to get caught. And I did. I worked for a company for 6 years or so, and was their top producer, hands down. Just, you know, I could do no wrong. And they liked to party and drink too, but they weren't alcoholics. See, that's the difference. So they thought that I just was starting to go crazy. That's what they thought. So I was called into their office and said, you know, maybe you need to go see somebody. So I did. And you know, psychiatrists have a bad name around the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in my opinion, it's undeserved, because we go and see psychiatrists, and what do in their presence? Well, if you're anything like me, you lie to them. I told them a little bit of truth, and you know, I got a little bit of relief from that little bit of truth that I told that man. It didn't last long, but I did get some relief for some short time. But you know, if anybody drinks like me, and you start saying to people and to yourself, I am going to control my drinking, you know the big one is just around the corner. And the big one was just about around the corner for me. I started to try to hide my drinking. You know, I still to this day don't know whether it's better to take a half a pint and put it in your coat pocket with the bottle down or up, which is better? You know, things like that. Is it better to stick it back here? Or these are the questions we ask. Anyway, I canceled out all that because one night my wife came to my place of business, and we've all been there. I was so drunk I couldn't walk. Tonight, liquor had not gotten to my head, it had gotten to my legs. And I couldn't open the door. And I finally did open the door, and she came in. And she probably did one of the first sane things she'd ever done. She called the owner of that business and told him that I was in his business and that I couldn't walk and that I was so drunk that I didn't know where I was. And he got him out of a dinner party, and he came to see me. And I immediately, literally, threw up on him. And you know, I had the thing that Milton had going for him when he came into this fellowship, and that was youth. Because you know where I was the next morning at 8:30? I was in this man's office. Hi, how you doing? Good morning. Let's have a good day today. Insane. Insane. They didn't fire me. 2 weeks later, I had one of the biggest things that I had ever had going on in this fellowship, or before this fellowship. That thing is called a resentment. I resented these people because they were now on to me. They knew who I was. So about this time, I called them up and I told them that I'd like to give their keys back to them. And they accepted them. Of course, I had a snoot full, and I had my little briefcase and my little coat and my little tie and didn't have a car, and had my briefcase, 100-degree weather, walking down 240 in Memphis. I was going to walk from Bartlett to East Memphis, which is about a 12-mile thing there. Alcoholism. You know, that man is still my friend today. He pulled over on that highway, came, found me, and took me home. There's people in this program that do care about us, outside of this program, that care about us too. I had hit my third bottom. I made a call to a treatment facility because I had something that some folks in AA today call 12-stepping. And I hate to keep quoting Milton, but he says it better than anybody. How do we 12-step in AA today sometimes? Do you have any insurance? I had some insurance. And so I got a snoot full, and my wife took me to a treatment center. And I know she was glad to drop me off and get rid of me. My God, I was a burden to her and to me. But I want you to know, for me personally, I found a woman who I believe God saved just for me. Because I want you to know, my wife Helen can take it on the chin and give you back love. See, I had no idea what love was. But you know, I told them at that treatment center that I wasn't any alcoholic, and I knew something about alcoholism, and I knew something about Alcoholics Anonymous, because my father had tried Alcoholics Anonymous and it didn't work. And I was college educated, and I knew blah, blah, blah. They said, fine, we've got a side over here just for you. It was called a psychiatric hospital. And they obliged me, and for the next week, I watched people with little booties on go up to the little counter and get some stuff that was probably as good as moonshine. They wouldn't even give me an aspirin. They were on to me. But you know, something happened there. I started to come to. I started to look in the eyes of these poor, sick people. And they were sick. They were hurting. They were mentally unbalanced. Truly. But you know, I started to feel something for them. I started, for the first time in years, to feel love. Because you see, unbeknownst to me, when my mother died and my father died, and when you see people die like that, the last conscious thought of my father is standing on a rainy veranda in Mexico. He had nothing on but an undershirt, and he was going to the bathroom on himself, saying, son, don't drink. Alcoholism. You get a funny idea, at least I did, about what love was. And I stood and looked at the eyes of these sick people, and I started to feel again. I started to feel a little bit of love for another human being, and I had no idea what I was feeling. A few days later, I told them that I was thinking that maybe I needed to go to the other side, because I knew I wasn't in the right place after a while. And you know, one day, and I'd like to scoff at what I'm about to say and ridicule it. I would have never believed that this person that is me would have ended up on my knees in a bathroom of a treatment center asking God to help me. But that's what happened. Didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous at this time. Been to church just a handful of times in my life. Well, why was I praying to God? Why? Well, our textbook tells us why. That deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the basic fundamental idea of God. And a light went off in my head. Because you know what, folks? All my life I had had foxhole prayers. All my life when I'd been in trouble. But it just never occurred to me until that moment that every single one of those foxhole prayers had always been answered. They had always been answered, and I just didn't recognize it. A few days later, I had a physician tell me, "Bill, could you go the rest of your natural life without eating rice?" And that hit me like no other statement had ever hit me before, because I knew that I could do that. Yeah, I could go without eating rice the rest of my natural life, but I knew for a fact that I couldn't go without drinking. I was an alcoholic. I had my friends, my family, my doctor, my business associates all tell me I had a drinking problem. But I didn't believe it. Alcoholism. That was surrender. For the first time, I had surrendered to the fact that I was an alcoholic. So step one took me. And I tell you, I got scareder than I'd ever been in my life at that point, because all my life I had never been able to follow through with anything I was told to do, ever, anything that was important. I knew I was an alcoholic, and I knew that the solution was Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew for a fact that I would not pick up the spiritual tools that I was being given. And I wouldn't pick them up because I hadn't picked up anything else. So now there I was. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew the solution was Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew that I couldn't do it. And you know, folks, I was right. I couldn't do it. I got out of that treatment center and stayed sober 6 months. And had a premeditated drunk. And stayed sober 4 months and had a premeditated drunk. In my drinking days at their worst, I remember shoving Helen into a wall and telling her I didn't want to see her again, and went back to an old apartment that hadn't had any electricity in it in months, and went and laid on a cold water bed at 3 a.m. And the next morning I woke up and came to, and you know what that's like, and I felt something on my back, and it was Helen. It was Helen. So see, I had had love. And she came home and I was drunk. I had been through treatment. I had stayed sober for now 4 months the second time, and I told her I wasn't drunk. And made her believe it, ridiculed her in front of friends and alcoholism. So you see, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since May 21st of 1989. But what's the difference in then and what I was doing when I wasn't staying sober? I started to let God do for me what I could not do for myself. Because you see, I had every right to be scared at that point that I wasn't going to pick up the spiritual tools that you all were offering me, because I didn't have the equipment to do it. I had to have God, and I couldn't have God without surrendering my ego. And you know, I know today that surrender is the most important part for me of beginning a life in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I can't tell anybody how to do it. But that's about what happened to me. I heard some people talking here last night about how some of the spark of this fellowship had come and gone a little bit from time to time. I think that happens to everyone from time to time. But you know, what made me keep coming back in the early days of my recovery is the fact that people like Milton and people like Jim and Roe and Tom, because I can tell you're that kind of person, got up, came over and shook my hand, said, "I'm glad to see you," and went back and sat down. Something that simple. So to me, the most important thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to show up. It's the most important thing. So if you've got out there, got 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, let somebody with 5 years do from the podium what you're not supposed to do, and I'm going to give you some advice. Go to meetings. And you see somebody new come in the door, get up, go over there, shake their hand, tell them you're glad to see them, and then go sit back down. Because we forget how much that means. We forget. And we forget that what we give in this fellowship and what I felt and what is the greatest power in the universe is love. And when you get up from across that room and you walk over and you shake somebody's hand that you haven't seen before, they feel that power. They feel that power. You see, that's the reason I knew the solution to my problem was in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you see, no one can be that blind not to be able to see it in your faces. Bill Wilson said that we in AA oftentimes settle for good when we could have great. And I believe that. I was at Jack H.'s group a while back, and a good friend of mine, he's not my sponsor, but he's as close to me as my sponsor, took me aside right before I was going to talk, and he said, "Bill, I don't know how you feel, but you're still on the fringe of AA. Hurt my feelings. But I thought about that. And you know, he cared enough about me that he didn't want me to just settle for good. And I want you to know that I appreciate y'all allowing me to share some of what is great about AA. Because you see, a person would have to be blind not to feel it here at Mount Eagle. Today, instead of having the ease and comfort that I found with a few drinks, I like to replace the word ease and comfort with love and service. It's so much more powerful than ease and comfort. And you know, I have pain in my life today. Who doesn't? But you know, when I'm honest with myself, which is not particularly often, I know that any time I have learned anything of any lasting value for me, it has always, without exception, come through pain. I can't say that I embrace pain today, but I can tell you this, with the help of you people, I struggle to see the reality that there is in pain and in living one day at a time. You see, as I see reality, I find that power. As I see reality, I find God, and I cannot do it on my own. I was going to Oxford, Mississippi, about a year and a half ago, and some of you tonight might be in the same spiritual or emotional place that I was at this time. And I was going with my good friend Bob, and Bob's got a few more years than me and is as active in AA as you'll ever see. And we got about 30 miles out of Memphis and it was dark, and I figured that that was a good time to ask someone this question. Bob, is this all there is? Maybe some of you have wanted to ask or have an answer to that question. Is this all there is to the deal, to life? He said, are you asking me, is this all there is? And I said, yeah, Bob, I'm asking. You're really asking me, huh? Said, yeah. Okay, I'm going to answer you, Bill. He said, what are we doing right now? And I said, well, we're going down here to Oxford. He says, yeah, but what are we going to do? Well, we're going to give a talk at this treatment center. He goes, yeah. And he said, Bill, have you hit your wife today? I said, no. He said, Bill, you have some money in your pocket? Yeah. You got a job? Do you try to love your fellow human being today? Are people better off because they've met you today on the street than they were if they hadn't met you? And I said, well, yeah, well, most of the time. And Bill, you sober today? Yeah, Bob, I'm sober today. You're asking me, Bill, is this all there is? Yeah, Bob, I'm asking you. You're damn right, Bill, this is all there is. And you know, that's enough today. Because today I know that what I'm describing by all there is I'm describing a way to find love. And you know, when I have love in my heart, I have gratitude. And I don't know about anybody else, but when I'm grateful, that fear that I've had all my life can't touch me. And you know, no bad thing in this world can either. And I only found that through you people. So again, I want to thank you for having me here. But more than that, I want to thank you, quote, old timers who weren't always old timers for having the patience and for keep coming back. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.